Well, let me come back to you for a moment, Mary Bailey. What is it like having somebody write a book about your life?
Well, I think it was pretty terrifying. It was very overwhelming. And but you know what? There's so many other people who deserve to be thought of and are responsible for making this restoration happen. It's not just me. It's about all of us, Amy included, who make a big difference in as we move forward and how Everglades restoration will be when it's finished.
Amy Green, let's just dig into the writing process a little bit, because writing any kind of book is a pretty monumental undertaking. And you spent 10 years working on it, researching it. What did you learn about it in the course of writing Moving Water?
Moving Water is the first book to tell the story of George and Mary Bailey. And George Bailey was just this dynamo of an Everglades activist who, at the time of his death, you know, his stature was, you know, probably on the level of the Secretary of the Interior at the time. He just was a torpedo on the issue. And he was really the first activist who was able to bring real resources to the table. You know, before George Bailey, you know, there were many people engaged on that issue very passionately, but no one really with the deep pockets to go toe-to-toe with other political interests like sugar growers, Big Sugar, you know, as we say in the political parlance, who were just extraordinarily powerful in the legislature, in Congress, and who many saw as, you know, very reluctant toward progress in Everglades restoration. George Bailey, as you said, Matt, was a wealthy real estate investor in Central Florida, very politically connected. And he was really the first who was able to bring those resources, bring those connections to the table on behalf of the Everglades. And unfortunately, he died very tragically in a plane crash in 1995. And after his death, Mary Bailey, within weeks, really, took up his cause and in 96 engaged in a ballot initiative that was aimed at taxing sugar growers to raise money for Everglades restoration. And at the time, this was a political campaign that was the most expensive in Florida history. And in some ways it succeeded, and in some ways it was not successful. And today, Mary Bailey remains very influential and very involved through the Everglades Foundation and the Everglades Trust, which you may remember the Everglades Trust gave Governor Ron DeSantis a very critical endorsement as he ran his campaign for governor on an environmental platform. Moving Water also is the first book to really document the influence of Paul Tudor Jones in Everglades restoration. And Paul Tudor Jones is a Wall Street tycoon, really. And he was George Bailey's best friend. And he almost single-handedly funded a lot of this very important political work back in the 1990s, the 96 ballot initiative that Mary Bailey led, and almost single-handedly funded Audubon's first Everglades position in South Florida. And Paul Tudor Jones did this while really shying away from media attention. And so that is another aspect of Everglades history that many people may not be aware of.
Right. And I'm sure as a writer and reporter, somebody who has that much influence but is a little bit media shy, I mean, that's got to be an interesting subject to write about. Speaking of investigations, Trevor Aronson, let me bring you back into this conversation. I mean, this is not the first project that you have worked with Amy Green on. You've worked on stories about the influence of the sugar industry in Florida before. I'm wondering, just as you watched Amy work on this particular project through the years of reporting on the Everglades, what have been some of the most surprising things that have come to light for you about this place in South Florida?
Yeah, I think the first project we worked with Amy on was maybe 2012 or 13. It was about money, Big Sugar's political influence through contributions, right? And again, I think this is another aspect of Florida that Floridians don't fully appreciate, which is, you know, the size and vast wealth of big sugar in the United States, and its willingness to put that wealth, you know, behind its political purposes and business causes. And so I think, you know, I think what's interesting about the Everglades, and I think a lot of what's interesting about Amy's reporting, is that it isn't just this story of, you know, this sensitive ecological environment that we have in many ways mishandled, right? It's a story about big business and the competing, you know, the competition between kind of, you know, development and industry versus, you know, preservation and how we strike that balance. And so I think, you know, what attracted us to do, you know, this podcast, you know, most recently was I really felt like it built on all of Amy's reporting over the last decade or so, which is just, you know, in the media environment we're in today, where, you know, there's so much pressure on reporters to do more and more stories every day. You know, that's not kind of a wealth of knowledge that you're often able to kind of tap into. And so I think for that reason, that's why it was incredibly important for us to work with Amy on this project. I mean, to me, I mean, you know, some of the most surprising things really came from drains. You know, as I mentioned, I'd read stories about Everglades restoration for as long as I can remember. And I don't think I fully appreciated some of the kind of harebrained schemes that they'd come up with to restore the Everglades, like the aquifer pump and like pumping water down. It's just like, I was not aware of that. And so to me, like that was kind of one of the, among the incredible things that we were throwing these millions and millions of dollars at Everglades, in restoration. And in many ways, the people restoring the Everglades were kind of really like, you know, what's the cliche? Like they were building the airplane while they were in flight. And that's very much, you know, where we are today, which to me is striking. I kind of came from this initially with the naive impression that the plan to restore the Everglades with all these millions and millions of dollars was much firmer than it really is.
Mary Barley, I wonder if, you know, having a reporter work on a book about your life, does that give you a kind of a new perspective on the work that you've been doing over the last quarter century?
Well, I guess it does, actually. It's a little embarrassing, actually. So I don't like to talk about myself in that kind of way. But, you know, I'm just in awe of, like, the positive comments she's received from the public and her contemporaries on Moving Waters. It's amazing. You know, restoration is bold, and it's an audacious undertaking with many moving parts and numerous governments and agencies, and there's good and evil, like we've just been talking about. You know, it's what's amazing to me is that Amy condensed all that, those years of advocacy, into just a little frank look back. And the look back for me has been, you know, it's a lot of things that I just put out of my mind. I didn't want to think about anymore. And now it just reminds me of how difficult the fight is and how difficult it's going to be going forward.
Thinking about that, though, Mary Barley, I mean, you're still clearly very passionate about the Everglades. And obviously that spirit has not waned over the years, but sort of thinking about the work that's gone into it and the challenges that you faced along the way, do you think, knowing what you know now, you would have blithely set out on this path 25 years ago?
Oh. I have no idea. I like to think that I would have, but I don't know. It has been very difficult at times, but then it's been so rewarding that why would you ever want to give up?
Yeah, and I guess there's so many things about environmental restoration where the hazards and the barriers seem so high. So I guess any kind of advance must seem like a pretty big deal.
Yes, and if you really look around and study it, you'll find out that every ecosystem is exactly like ours. It has the exact same problems that the Everglades does. And if we can be successful, that's what's going to be the greatest gift we could give to the planet. Is if we are successful, then many, many other ecosystems will know what to do and how to do it.
Amy, when you came back from the reporting that you'd done on your book, you essentially had a list of questions. You had kind of like a notebook full of ideas. And, you know, in the newsroom, we like to bounce ideas off each other. And I remember distinctly having one conversation with you where you essentially just presented me with a list of things about the Everglades. And you're like, I want to do more reporting on this. Let's do a project. Just kind of walk us through what that process was like.
Right. So, you know, my deadline for my manuscript was December 31st, 2019. And so 2019, I was writing pretty furiously. And by the end of that year, I was writing like I have never written in my life. And And there was a moment when I was on deadline with the book and I was, you know, researching all this Everglades restoration stuff, and it's very complicated. And I was making a million phone calls, and I stopped and I thought, this is really messed up. And I stopped and I made a list of all the ways that Everglades restoration is messed up, kind of, you know, like climate change and some other things. And just a few weeks after that, I listened to a podcast from a very fascinating podcast from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting and Louisville Public Radio called The Dig. And that's how I got the idea for Drained. And so we ended up doing a 4-episode miniseries podcast timed to drop in December 2020, which is the 20-year anniversary of Everglades restoration being signed into law. And we each episode looked at a component of Everglades restoration. We did one on water storage, one on flow, climate change, and water quality. And so that was how that came about.
It was interesting to me. I mean, obviously, and we discussed this a little bit before about how the Everglades is kind of like a personality in and of itself, right? It's like this living organism. It's kind of hard to wrap your arms around. I mean, it's literally enormous, and it's this massively complicated system that you can't really grasp unless you spend a very long time researching it. But it was interesting to me also kind of reflecting on some of the sounds we heard in the podcast, Amy, and especially, you know, some of the political voices from 20 years plus ago, like especially that speech that President Bill Clinton made in the, you know, the waning days of his administration. Of course, all eyes were on Florida at that point. This is 2000, and that was because we'd gone through the kind of election debacle of that year. But here was Bill Clinton making this speech, this kind of, you know, grandiose speech about how this project was going to save the glades, and it would be, he sort of referenced other you know, natural wonders across the United States. And it's interesting to reflect how far we've come in those 20 years and just how intractable in some ways the problem is. I mean, all the money that's been poured into it, and there's still much more work to do. Do you kind of have a sense, Amy, having spent this time reporting on it, that you feel like you know where this project is headed and what the next chapter might be?
It's very complicated, and I would not pretend to be an environmental or a water engineer or anything like that. But you're right, Matt. You know, when this was signed into law in December 2000, no one had ever seen anything like this. You know, at the time, this was billed as the largest environmental restoration effort anywhere in the world ever. And today, it is still one of the most ambitious attempts at ecological restoration in the world. And so in many ways, no one has ever seen anything like this. You know, the effort is composed of 68 projects, and each project on its own is just monumental. You know, one of the most important projects is a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, and that plan has been altered a little bit through the years. But when construction first started on that reservoir, it was going to be the largest reservoir of its kind in the world. You know, they're building filter marshes, which are, you know, human engineered wetlands, and they clean the water as the water flows through these wetlands. The vegetative tissues absorb the pollutants, and over time, the water flows cleaner. And these are wetlands that are the largest of their kind in the world. So this is something that really stretches the imagination in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Trevor, you were talking before, or you alluded to some of the kind of mind-bogglingly strange, in some ways, ideas to solve some of the problems of the Everglades, including pumping vast quantities of water underground to try and deal with some of that runoff. And we also hear some sound from a kind of promotional movie that was made, you know, decades ago, right? And I wonder, Trevor, just kind of reflecting on this as a podcast producer, as an investigative reporter, what do you think about when you hear some of the voices from last century when they were kind of just getting started on engineering this to suit human needs at the time?
Yeah, I mean, to me, like that the promotional video from the 50s or whatever it was, I mean, it strikes me as kind of like the old manifest destiny, right? This idea that like we as humans and Americans can just manipulate the earth however we want and we'll be fine. It'll be fine. And it turns out that I think, you know, obviously we didn't do a very good job, right? Like we drained the Everglades and allowed for development. And then we created a host of other problems that we are now grappling with through the last 20 years of restoration. But I think what was so interesting to me, you know, is that like that kind of arrogance, this idea that, you know, we can manipulate the earth as we want, you know, is a lesson we didn't clearly learn from, right? Because one of the solutions, you know, proposed at one point was this idea of like pumping the water into the aquifer, right? You know, damn the consequences kind of thing, even though, you know, that would have kind of clearly risked the drinking water quality of the aquifer itself, right? And so, you know, I mean, I don't, as just like Amy said, you know, I don't pretend to be an environmental engineer or someone who, you know, knows what that answer is. But I was just struck by, you know, how many terrible problems we created through draining the Everglades, and that in many ways, the solutions that we came up with, you know, raise questions about even worse problems that we might have in the future, or similar, or whether that we were just trading one problem for another. And to me, that was really fascinating. I mean, I understand that this is a terribly complex problem, and it's difficult to kind of boil it down and point out some of these absurd plans. But at the same time, it's clear that, you know, we really haven't fully learned the lesson of, you know, maybe we shouldn't mess with the environment as much as we did.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I feel like you don't need to be an environmental engineer. I mean, obviously that would help to kind of give you a sense of just exactly what's going on here. But we're living in Florida, right? We're residents of the state. And I think the thing that struck me, one of the things that struck me about the podcast, having kind of come to the end of the project and listening back to it, is this really does affect everyone. I mean, you don't have to even live in South Florida to know that there is going to be some impact from what happens in the Everglades, whether it's restoration, whether it's, you know, if plans don't go quite right, because people keep moving to Florida, there's going to be a need for water, and that need is not going away. And, you know, what happens in the River of Grass, whatever happens in the next 10, 20 years, is going to have an impact on all of us.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what's fascinating to me, obviously, is that, you know, I think anyone who's paying attention understands that Florida is in a very precarious, you know, situation with climate change, right? And the conversation that is often talked about, which is important, is, you know, sea level rise and what areas of the state will be, you know, habitable in the long term and how we can mitigate all of this. But the secondary conversation, which is this deals with, which I don't think is happening enough, is, you know, what is the drinking water supply going to be like? How is climate change going to be affecting that? You know, there may still be many patches of land to live on in Florida, but, you know, what we'll be doing for water at that point. And again, which is why I was like, so, you know, my mind was so boggled by the idea of like pumping dirty water into the aquifer, right? Like, well, that's your idea for saving it? I mean, because you're, you know, essentially kind of creating another problem. But you're right. I mean, I think, you know, this gets us to the larger conversation of climate change. But, you know, I think, you know, the Florida's ecosystem is so interconnected that these programs are really something that we should be paying attention to when we think about like the future habitability of our state.
Mm-hmm. Mary Barley, just thinking about that 20-year mark since the Everglades Restoration Plan was signed into law, what's your take on where we are now? And I'm wondering too, do you reflect on what George Barley would think about all of this?
Well, you know, I think where we are now highlights how dysfunctional and transactional our government is. Not only the political actors, but also a lot of the bureaucrats who contribute to the delays. And so, you know, the scale is staggering, but I still think that restoration can be achieved. And further to what Trevor said, I mean, water is our base, economic basis in Florida is tourism. Mm-hmm. And water. If we don't have water, we don't have tourism. That means all of Florida, not just South Florida, not just the Everglades. And so we have to be thinking, and, you know, Everglades is a huge ecosystem, but then we have to go up to the next level and get out of the box and, you know, think big. You know, but it takes, to go back, it takes political will from all our governments, tribal, local, state, federal, and public participants to move these immovable objects. And George, I think he would have been incensed at the slow pace, and he would be demanding accountability.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Mary Barley, the Everglades need right at this moment?
It needs the political will and funding. We need $725 million for the next 4 years from the federal government. We need a matching fund from the state of Florida. It's a 50-50 partnership. And that would probably finish 90% of the projects. But you can't finish these projects with dribble and drab of money. You have to have, it's like a mortgage. You have to know that you can build the whole house or you can't even start it. And so that is one big problem with the Everglades, obviously, is how do we get the money, which is really important. And we get the money by having people like us demand that they do this restoration and they do it properly. And they do it scientifically, not just for people, but they do it for critters and the environment too.
Amy Green, what's next for you as far as reporting on the Everglades? I get the sense that the story, the reporting isn't quite done yet.
Right. Yeah. I'm totally obsessed with it. And I can't help myself. I think I may have shared with you in the past, Matt, that over the holidays, I took my 7-year-old daughter down to the Everglades. She has been home with me during the pandemic and has been hearing me work on the podcast and on the book. And she said that she wanted to see the Everglades for herself. And so I said, okay. And my mother and I took her down to the Everglades, and I just, went to the library and was looking for some books for her and just got the idea for writing a children's book for children about the Everglades. So I just kind of can't stop.
Tune to 90.7 WMFE or 89.5 WMFV next Thursday, March 4th at noon to hear this conversation on Intersection. Thanks so much for joining us, giving us your feedback, and for being part of our listener-supported community-based station. If you'd like to make a donation to support our work and to strengthen independent journalism in your community, visit WMFE.org. Thanks so much again, and have a great evening.